Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're off! We're off! Oh, God. It's like, yeah. This is a rare occasion when I was here before Nathaniel. And and I realise why I always leave it to the last minute, because it's like, it's just like this countdown to this impending doom.
No, go on.
But then it's over in 2 hours, but it just feels like the last minute before it turns it turns to the hour that we start. The last minute, it always drags, and then I get nervous.
Also, I mean, you don't need to know these, listeners, but we're also starting an hour later than we usually would. And it's given me like extra time to do stuff, which is a bad idea because it makes me late then, because I've added more things into my morning and then I'm rushing. But, yeah. You know, it's fine, isn't it? It's fine. It's fine. We're both here now.
It's all right.
It's going to be like a normal fan club.
You're listening to Fan Club. My name is Nick, and this is
Nathaniel Metcalf.
And this is Nick and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club.
Fan Club.
That's what it's called. And first rule of Fan Club is tell your friends about Fan Club. Tell your friends. Just simple, plain and simple. And the second rule of Fan Club is please,
for the love of God, tell your friends. The third rule of Fan Club is stay indoors again. That's what we've got. which as you're hearing this, you will be back in lockdown if you're in the UK, and possibly in other countries as well, and depending on where you're listening.
A proper lockdown. So that's exciting. But today is the day after the US election, and so that's been all over the... I don't really understand how it works and any of the ins and outs of it. I mean, but there you go.
I don't either, and I feel almost to be a little bit informed is almost not worth it. To try and find out now is like, you know what, I don't care the rest of the 4 years, so I don't need to know now. I'll find out in due course. Currently, we do not know the result, but on Friday you probably will. So we're in a sort of Schrodinger's cat box.
Yes.
In regards to news from America. And we're recording this on Wednesday, the 4th of November. We've had Halloween. We have not yet had Bonfire Night that we can't have. And we're currently not in lockdown. But when you hear this, we shall be back in lockdown. Do you know, Natalie, can you tell us if any of our Maltese listeners will be in lockdown currently, or... I said we're all in lockdown, but maybe a big Maltese fan base might be free as a bird.
How are we doing in Malta? That's my big question. Are we still ahead of everyone else, or are we still like the number one? Did we have more listeners than Joe Rogan once?
In Malta? Something like that, I think. 86th in Malta this week. Is that comedy or is that all podcasts?
That's... Just in comedy.
Just in comedy.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, I mean, I think that there's actually a lot of factual stuff that happens in this show. We're really like current affairs in a way.
We are. We're talking about the election.
If that current affair was happening in 1980...
in a cinema.
In some sort of cinema. So what have you been a fan of this week, Nathaniel? How are you? You all right? How do you feel about lockdown?
I'm all right about it in the idea that it's a month. I feel like it needs to happen and, you know, and I welcome whatever people need to do to make it work. I feel a bit like I probably didn't really take advantage of not being in lockdown so much, very purposefully. So it's a bit, it's a little bit gloomy. I'll see what it's like at the end of it. I think if it's a month and it has a big effect, great. And if it has a big effect, I'm happy to keep doing it. Well, I say happy. I'm not happy about it, but I think it's probably necessary. So I am on board with it.
I think it's one of them things which is just sort of like, yeah, if it lowers the cases and it helps people in the long run, then we just need to sort of do it to stop it escalating. But I also think that if we're going to just stay in for a month and then we're going to be let out, you know, is it kind of like, are we in for a month and then out for a month and then in for a month and then out for a month? It's just kind of like, it could be like this perpetually forever. Mm. I don't know. It's pretty tedious, isn't it?
But yeah, I mean, this has been my fear all along, like, of the idea of if you open up at a certain point and we're allowed to do certain things but not everything, whereas I think in other countries it feels like people seem to be much more back to normal, it made me think, well, let's just stay locked down for longer and then we'll go back to normal. Natalie's informed us, okay, that Malta have, as of today, I've recorded 84 new cases, so we don't know if they're in lockdown or not. But stay healthy, Malta.
Yeah, where did I go? I had to go to IKEA the other day, and everyone was wearing masks. But, like, it was an absolute shit show. Like, it was more crowded than I would have seen it at Christmas. You know, like, everyone is basically going, well, if I'm going to be locked up for a month, I'm going to do some fucking DIY. And just, there was a queue that was, it went all the way, you know, you get that last warehouse, you've been to IKEA, you get that last warehouse section where you pick up all of, like, the shelves and the chairs and stuff, and you've got these huge kind of, like, storage kind of unit, bits where everything is stacked up. So I guess it's like getting the keys to Argos and being able to go over the counter and look around in the warehouse back there. But the queues were just all through the aisles. That, you know, like, it was just that, like, it got all the way through IKEA. It was horrible, horrific. People kept banging into me and, like, literally slamming, you know, I was trying to be invisible, basically, by kind of, like, staying very still, because I was with someone that was looking for stuff, and so I just tried to keep out of the way, and people would just, like, slam right into me, and then you just think, oh, right, we're in the final hurdle now, we can leave, and the queue was, like, an hour long, and fucking hell, it was horrible, and there were just cunts, you know, most people were wearing masks, but there were just some cunts that weren't wearing masks, and you just think, and there was, like, announcements continuously saying, you know, in the interest of safety, health and safety, you know, it's, you have to wear a mask. And it was just cunts that are just, they were selling masks, and cunts that were just ignoring them, and you're just like, for fuck's sake, do you know what I mean? It's like, you are a cunt.
Yeah.
You know, everyone is wearing a mask except for you two. And yeah, you're just, like, acting like we're the pricks. And it's just kind of like, you're fucking scum.
Yeah, the anti-mask people are, like, the worst people in the world, I think, at the minute. And I think it's the... and it all just boils down to... They've got reasons for doing it. But when you talk... When you, like, read anything they've written about it, they talk about it, it all just boils down to, you've just been told to do something that you don't want to do. So you're making a sort of a virtue of not doing something. And it's just antisocial and selfish.
Yeah.
There's no other... It's like, just do it. And my thing is, like, when people talk about it as well, and they talk about it, oh, well, the thing about masks is they're so uncomfortable, aren't they? And you go, no, it's like a bit of cloth. It's just not uncomfortable. It's like not even nearly the right word. It's perfectly fine.
Yeah. And it's like, nobody really wants to wear a mask. Fine. But nobody really wants there to be, like, a global pandemic. So let's just fucking all wear a mask until it's over, and then we can fucking go back to not wearing a mask.
Yeah.
It's like people... It's like the assumption is that, oh, some people really enjoy wearing a mask. Somebody said to me, they said, do you hate wearing a mask because you get recognised less? And I said, no, I hate wearing a mask because I get recognised exactly the same amount. but yeah, anyway, so I had the horrible IKEA thing, but, like, yeah, I guess everyone's just going to be doing fucking DIY for a month. So what have you been a fan of this week, Nathaniel?
Seen a bunch of stuff, really. On your recommendation, I watched Yubi Halloween on Halloween, and I thought your
Halloween,
and I thought your description of it last week was spot on, so it's probably not worth me adding anything, because I thought exactly what you said. It felt very nice and Halloween-y, and I did my other thing on Halloween where I watched...
Oh, but hang on, because I wanted to ask you.
Oh, yeah.
So Hubie Halloween, this is a spoiler, but I mean, in as much as you can spoil Adam Sandler comedy. So there's a cameo in it from Rob Schneider, right?
Yeah.
And so there's sort of like a serial killer type guy that's wearing a mask, and he's got long blonde hair, and he's wearing a mask, and you see that he's got blonde hair, and then about halfway through the film, he takes the mask off, and you realise it's Rob Schneider, right? I thought, do you think that is because the long blonde hair is meant to be kind of like it's meant to imply that it's David Spade.
Oh.
And that when he takes the mask off, you go, oh, it's not David Spade, it's Rob Schneider.
It might be. If it is, that's quite a good joke.
Because I thought, because only in retrospect, because he's got, for the rest of the film, he's got this long blonde hair, and I was just thinking, why has he got, like, Owen Wilson hair? And then I was just like, well, maybe it's David Spade hair, and you're meant to assume that it's going to be a cameo from David Spade. And then the big bait and switch is that, oh, no, it's not. It's the other one that's in all of his films.
It could be. I quite like that idea. It wouldn't surprise me if that was the case.
I like that idea. I mean, it would have to be like one of the most sophisticated jokes in any of his films.
No, I can see that, because there's no real reason for him to have long blonde hair otherwise, right?
There's no reason for it at all. There's no reason at all. But I only thought about it afterwards, and I thought, if that is the joke, then I think it's a funny joke. But
it's a very, like, big-hearted film. Has quite a sort of 80s-y thing to it, or something. It's very, like, I don't know. Yeah, it's big-hearted, but I suppose a lot of his films are, right? They're kind of, part of his thing. They're quite sweet and very...
They are, but a lot of them have that, like, walk. We talked about it before. They walk that knife edge between being really sweet, but they have their cake and eat it, because they are actually quite kind of like abusive as well. To anyone that's different. But I think that he's sort of like changing with the times. I guess having daughters and stuff has changed that as well. And it felt like he was the butt of the jokes again, you know, as opposed to sort of like making fun of other people. But yeah, I just thought it was a really sweet film. And like genuinely creepy in places, which I thought was great.
Yeah, I think that's a good line to tread as well. It's not, certainly not scary. It feels like the kind of Halloween movie you could show a kid and it would be fine.
Yeah, but there's so many sex jokes.
I suppose.
And so it's sort of like, I think that is his version of a family film, right? But like his mum with all of the T-shirts, it's just kind of like, I mean, it's not a kid's film, but at the same time, it's not for adults.
But I think a lot of the films that I grew up with, in hindsight, feel quite adult in compared with kids' films now. And you go, oh, right, like a film like... the first time I saw Gremlins was because it was a 15, was on TV. And as an adult, I look back at it and go, oh, it's basically a kid's film, but they really pushed the boundary of what was acceptable. It's that thing about talking about Poltergeist again, of being like almost like a Spielberg family film. Well,
Poltergeist was like a 15 in America. Mm. And there's a bit when a guy claws the skin off his own face, and you're just like, how is that a fucking PG? Mm. But it's sort of like Back to the Future and Ghostbusters, where it's kind of like, they're kids' films, they're 80s kids' films, though. So there's like swearing and stuff in them, but they're still for kids. And it's kind of like that thing, isn't it? Where it's kind of like, it's not like this overly sanitized kind of...
I imagine that's probably it, that someone like Adam Sandler is making a film at Netflix, and he's thinking, I'll be like a kid's film. It'll be like the kind of kid's films that he grew up on. So it feels like, I'll just do like a kid's movie, like that, like a Ghostbusters-y, Gremlins.
And his daughters are in it. So it's kind of like, you know, he's not put anything in there. I think he just wanted to make a kid's film.
Mm.
But a kid's film with, you know, blowjob jokes in it. And... Yeah. you know, it's just, yeah, and anal sex jokes and stuff. And you go, okay, cool, right, brilliant. If you're happy, then that's fine.
I think it's like, that's, you know, when you're a kid, I think a lot of the jokes like that go over your head. And it's only when you watch them back, you go, oh, I didn't realise Dan Aykroyd got a blowjob off a ghost.
That made me feel really weird but that was like a huge deleted section of the film where is it Ray and Winston go and spend the night at a haunted castle, and then they just cut it and it became a montage, which I, you know, we may have talked about this before. I mean, I watched Anchorman yesterday, and I don't know, I'm just not really much of a fan, but I think the main difference between Anchorman and Anchorman 2 is that with Anchorman, they made the film in the edit. They filmed so much, and then they made the film in the edit. And with Anchorman 2, they basically, what you see is what they shot, because everyone's schedules were so big and all over the place. And the same thing with Ghostbusters, where Ghostbusters, they tried out loads of stuff when they filmed it. And, like, Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray were playing separate characters, like homeless characters in Central Park. And then they just cut everything down. And so you get these, like, montage sequences, which... that's not true with Ghostbusters 2, though, because there was a huge subplot with Eugene Levy playing Rick Moranis's cousin. Hmm. And I think that... But I think what they did with that was they filmed Rick Moranis basically said that he wouldn't do the sequel unless his character was beefed up. So they wrote some additional scenes with Eugene Levy, and then they were always going to cut them, but they just did it to sort of like placate him. But yeah, I think it's kind of like one of those things where they just sort of like made stuff in the edit. I mean, I've forgotten what I was talking about.
It was.
How did I get onto that?
From UB Halloween. It made sense at the time. I knew where you were going with it.
I don't know why I'm
talking about Ghostbusters. Oh, the blowjob joke being.
Oh, the blowjob joke. Yeah. No, that did make me feel really weird. But, like, I don't know.
It just means that it goes over the heads of kids. It's not something that. Like, no. It's fine. It's fine because you either don't understand it because you're too young. Yeah. And then later you do, and it just has a different meaning. So you're essentially watching two different films, and it's sort of harmless because it's not like you're, you know.
Yeah, it's not hard.
It's kind of harmless anyway, really.
Sure. But I did think that T-shirt joke in Hubie Halloween was great. Like, every time it cut back to her, then and she's wearing a different T-shirt, I thought that was a very funny
observation that all the women in it are dressed as Harley Quinn, and it then just becomes a running joke.
Yeah,
everyone is, and it's just that kind of. I guess that was maybe what was happening last Halloween, but it seems like really on the nose, and really of the moment that joke. Like, of course, you know, it's not even something I've witnessed, but as soon as you see it referenced, you go, "Of course, that must be true."
Yeah,
of course it is.
Yeah, but also that running joke with the T-shirt is kind of like it gives that character something to do.
Yes,
you know what I mean? Yeah. It means that she's got a purpose to be in the film. Rather than kind of like her having absolutely nothing to do for the majority of the film. Do you know what I mean? Talking, I don't want to spoil it. It's not a work of genius. It's just a really kind of like enjoyable film.
Not Hitchcock.
No, but it's, I thought that it sort of like, it made enough of an effort to be funny, to be entertaining. It catches a vibe, like a seasonal sort of like feeling, and there was some like genuinely kind of like spooky bits in it where you go, oh wow, that's really well done. So I thought it was sort of like went above and beyond. I don't know whether it's because my expectations for those sorts of films have been sunk so low, but. I think that he's one of them people that if he does do something good, you should actually acknowledge it because he needs to have some sort of... I think he does read reviews and he needs to have some sort of barometer of when he's doing well.
I mean, it really made me think, oh, I'm going to watch more of these, but then I'm so kind of reluctant to watch the bad ones where you go... Like, when you watch a good one, you go, I could happily do another 2 hours of this. Like, it just feels like there's another... You know, it's almost like I probably need to... get a list of the good ones I never saw Ridiculous Six, partly because you told me not to. And I was like, all right, I don't need to see it. But in principle, I like the sound of it.
Yeah. I mean, it came out the same year as Hateful Eight. And you go, Ridiculous Six, yeah, I know what that is. That's, you know, it's the Magnificent Seven. Right, great, brilliant. And then you watch it and you go, fucking hell, how is it 2.5 hours long? Mental, absolutely mental. Anyway, what else have you seen this week?
I watched...
What did you watch on Halloween?
I watched that, and I watched two Hammer Horrors that I'd never seen. One, which was Lust for a Vampire, which is all right. It's all right. And I watched one that was really good called The Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll, which feels actually like one of those good ones that you could recommend to people that don't like Hammer movies. Right. Like, oh, it's just a really good film. It's just really... And it's really ahead of its time as well, really... Feels like it's quite boundary pushing and quite shocking for that. You go, oh, this must have been really, you know, must have been quite mind blowing at the time. It's quite a sort of smart script that they paid someone a lot, paid a guy called Wolf Mankiewicz, who was a big kind of screenwriter at the time, to do it. And he did this sort of Jekyll and Hyde where, I mean, it's kind of similar to something like The Nutty Professor, but it's about different kind of Victorian societies. And he's just good. He's good-looking. Mr. Hyde's essentially good-looking. Right. And Dr. Jekyll isn't. And it's a sort of undersized, seedy Victorian London and how it's all very kind of... It's two-faced in itself, so it's saying two faces. It's how, you know, you sort of... If you're rich, you can kind of get away with stuff.
Right.
It's sort of like that kind of...
So it's got political... It's got social commentary.
Yeah. And you go, oh, it's actually quite a smart... It's aiming higher than a lot of those Hammers are.
Do you remember that Michael Caine Jekyll and Hyde thing?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, yeah.
And so he made that, and then he also made Jack the Ripper, right?
Mm. Jack the Ripper was first, I think.
But was it sort of like a spiritual sequel?
Yeah, it was sort of like, that was good, so let's do another one in the same vein.
Yeah. Yeah, I just remember them being on TV at a certain point and feeling like...
I think they were massive at the time because they were like late 80s and at a time when Michael Caine is still like a movie star in Hollywood. So I think the idea that you'd got him to do a couple of TV gothic things seems like what a coup for ITV, you know, to have this sort of big movie star come back and do these TV shows.
I remember them really, really, really freaking me out.
Yeah.
Especially Jekyll and Hyde. I can't really remember Jack the Ripper that much. I just remember whenever he changed, he got really sweaty.
Mm.
But maybe this is just a misremembered thing. But I just remember the transformation sequence has been really bizarre. Have you ever seen Curse of the Werewolf with Oliver Reed?
Yeah, I like that a lot.
I've never seen that, right? So tell me about that.
That is... Oliver Reed, sort of his starring role, because I think his first Hammer is Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll, which he shows up for like a couple of scenes. But I think he made 8 movies for Hammer right at the beginning of his career.
Right.
Sort of before, so he's not really a star. And I think his first starring role is Curse of the Werewolf. And in that, it's about this sort of, it's completely separate from things like The Wolfman. And it's more, seems to be based on a kind of gypsy curse or something. So it's this sort of, it's a thing where if you're born on Christmas Day, you have some sort of werewolf element to you or something. It's that sort of, and it's all very, I think it's set in sort of Spain, I think. And it's one of like the universal Hammers. So it's when Hammer had loads of distributors, they basically worked with all the big American distributors. And the ones that they made through Universal, they really took advantage of those properties that Universal had.
Right.
So they do things like Evil of Frankenstein, where Frankenstein starts looking, he's got the kind of square Boris Karloff head again.
Right, yeah.
And
isn't that David Prowse?
Yeah. Yeah, it right. is. And I think they do Curse of Werewolf simply because they haven't done a werewolf film before. And they get to be like, oh, it's like a Universal werewolf movie. But it doesn't seem to have anything in common with The Wolfman.
Is it filmed in Bray?
Oh, yeah, they're all, like, filmed. They're all filmed at that. I don't know if it will be Bray. At some point, they move away from Bray. But, again, they just move to another old house.
Right.
I think Bray's the very earliest ones, I think.
Oh, right.
So I think up to the early 60s. I think that's a little bit later.
Right.
But at the time, they're trying to, they're kind of moving away slightly from Cushing and Lee because they're just working so much elsewhere and they're trying to get new stars in. So that's one where they've basically got Oliver Reed, who's been like a co-star in a lot of them, and they've kind of ushered him up to the top spot. But I think for Oliver Reed, it's pretty much like his first starring role.
Yeah. That's good. Right, so I've got... Because I've got a Hammer box set, but it doesn't come with the Hammer box set. And I think I like Werewolf... So, out of the original Universal, I think Wolfman is probably my favourite. But I also really love the Invisible Man films from Universal. But that original one with Claude Rains is just, I think, just brilliant.
Yeah. That's brilliant.
And this, and especially, well, what's great about the Invisible Man movies is that you can really see the special effects and the technology evolve over the films, and they actually get better and better in terms of special effects. The films don't necessarily get better. The second one with with Vincent Price in it is really great. But I really like those original ones. And then, so I really like werewolf films, American Werewolf in London, The Howling a little bit. I'm not huge on The Howling, but I like the idea of werewolf films, but they're sort of like really difficult to get right, I think. And I really like the remake, the Wolfman remake with Benicio del Toro, even though it's like deeply flawed, but I just even find like the making of that film really fascinating.
I do. I think that's, but you can kind of see the film in it, I think. I think you can see, like, it's very easy to watch the good film in it. You can totally see what they're going for. And I think it's, like, I think it's a pretty successful film. I liked it a lot when I saw it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a shame that it becomes, like, it's a shame that it's CGI in the end.
Yeah. Well, because it's aged worse than American Werewolf in London.
Mm.
I find, like, you can see... I don't think the special effects in American Werewolf in London are flawless, but, like... And I think that the design of the actual wolf is kind of a bit... you know, he's got, like, really broad shoulders. It's like there's somebody in it that's sort of, like, walking around on all fours as opposed to it being, like, an actual animal. So I think it's kind of like... Yeah, it's not perfect, but it's definitely aged really well. Whereas you look at the CGI and the Wolfman from 10 years ago... And it's just aged so badly.
Mm.
But the making of the film is sort of fascinating, where Joe Johnston... Was it Mark Romanek?
Yeah, who came first?
Mark Romanek was originally meant to be on it, and he was brought on by Benicio del Toro, and then he had creative differences with Universal, walked off the project, and Joe Johnston had something like 2 weeks to prep it.
Right. I mean, Joe Johnston's one of those people. I think... He's like, he's brought in, he's like a journeyman director. And yet I really like his movies. I just think he's always like, there's something about his sort of aesthetic or something that always makes me think, I love it. I love The Rocketeer. I love Captain America, the First Avenger, which is basically like The Rocketeer. I like The Wolfman. I like Jurassic Park 3. It's like he's not trying to do, I think it's what you keep saying about like people that do like B-movies. He's just really good at them. I just think he's... He's almost like he should be your first choice, really, to do this sort of material.
Who did Young Sherlock Holmes? Was that Christopher Columbus or was that...
Was it Christopher Columbus? I think Young Sherlock... Is it Barry Levinson?
Is it?
I think it might be, you know.
What, who did the Flintstones?
Yeah, I think so. Was that... No, was that Brian...
Oh, we've had this conversation before.
Barry Levinson, is it? It is Barry, says Barry.
Barry Levinson. All right, sure. Okay.
I think it's Columbus writing it, isn't it? I think it's all that lot.
That's a great film, Young Sherlock Holmes.
I haven't seen it in ages.
Oh, I've seen it within the last 3 years, and I think it's like it's aged really well. I just thought it was one of those really great films. Like that's what we're talking about, really. It's kind of like, in terms of kids' films, it was spooky and it was. There was like real danger and threat in there, but it was also just like this really sort of magical kids film. It was, Young Sherlock Holmes, because it potentially shit. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
Like you've done a Sherlock Holmes Jr. kind of story, but I just thought it was brilliant.
I was in a pub a few years ago, probably about 2 or 3 years ago now, and one of my mates said, "Sherlock Holmes is behind you." And as I turn around, you look around thinking, what are you going to look at? Who are you going to see? What actor is it going to be? Is it somebody who looks a bit like Sherlock Holmes? Is it just someone with a deerstalker on? What are you going to see when you turn around and someone says that? And it was the bloke who was young Sherlock Holmes. And it was like, no, hadn't changed a bit, just older, but exactly the same face.
Yeah.
Incredible. Please, please punch.
Did you get his autograph?
No, I didn't.
Nah.
Nah. Exciting, though.
Let's play a song and then keep talking.
Because that's the job we've got to, haven't we?
That's the point of the show.
Flowers will bloom and all will be fine, but nothing'll grow on this burnt, cursed ground. 'Cause the breath of the dead is the only sound.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're off. We're back again. Natalie says that that song sounded like Marilyn Manson. And yes, it was from his Brutal Planet album from 2000, where he was basically playing catch-up with... he hadn't done like an album since... Last Temptation in 1994-93, and so it was like basically he'd had health problems and stuff, and he'd released some live albums, and then he basically was like, right, I'm going to start recording albums again in 2010, and he was just basically playing catch up with whatever was popular at the time. So he did sort of like a couple of industrial metal albums that were basically, oh, Marilyn Manson is big at the moment, so I'll try and sound a bit like him. But I think I hated Brutal Planet when I first heard it. And then I ended up doing Edinburgh in 2004, and it was the only CD that I'd taken with me to Edinburgh. And so I listened to it, like, every day until I eventually... I think it's one of his best albums now. I think it's great. But, you know, so if you don't like something at first, bring...
It's still shit forever.
Just listen to it over and over and over again on repeat. And then,
and it might get better. It might be awful. Might just be a terrible thing you've done yourself.
I've seen quite a lot this week in terms of, I really like the idea. Part of what I liked about Hubie Halloween was that it really captures kind of Halloween in a way that a lot of, I saw Texas Chainsaw Massacre this month. I think that is such a good film, but I don't, it's kind of like a summer film, you know. I don't feel like just because it's a horror film that it really encapsulates, you know, that not all horror is kind of like appropriate for Halloween, I think. I think it's got to sort of like evoke the season. But so I watched the remake of The Invisible Man this week.
The most recent one.
Mm-hmm. And like I said, it's one of my favourite Universal movies. Mm-hmm. And when you watch it, I thought it was brilliant, right? At the remake, I thought it was absolutely brilliant. I think it's genuinely scary. I think she is incredible, the main actress.
Elizabeth Moss.
She was in Get Out as well, wasn't she? She's sort of...
No, she's in Us. She's in the follow-up thing, isn't it? The next
Did I say Get Out? Yeah, she's in Us. And then plays Shirley Jackson, right?
Yeah, I saw that film yesterday.
Yeah, and what? I love Shirley Jackson. She's incredible.
I thought it was a terrible film, but, oh, really? I mean, people love it. I don't know what they like about it. It's like, she's great. She's always been great and stuff. I know her from Mad Men, where she's Peggy in Mad Men, and she deserves lots of success. And I feel this Shirley Jackson film is her saying, listen, I've done all this stuff. I've done, I haven't really had my due yet. And so what I'm looking for is like an Oscar, and they've given her like an Oscar movie where, rather than being what she's like in every other film, she does this quite a big performance.
Right.
And it's just like, nah.
Really?
I just thought the film was really, I thought it was kind of lame, very silly. And
that's really a shame.
Yeah, I think it's a shame. I was looking forward to it.
That's a shame. But I think if it highlights Shirley Jackson and it kind of like puts a bit of a spotlight on her, then I think that's great. She wasn't really... she wasn't really appreciated within her own lifetime. Mm-hmm. She used to write sort of short stories that got published in newspapers and stuff, and then she became an alcoholic and she wasn't really acknowledged at the time. And then she became a lot more successful.
Is it funny? There's been lots of stuff recently, isn't there? There was stuff about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which sort of changes all the kind of history of Hollywood real life people. And there's been that same thing recently about there's been this trailer for this David Bowie film and everyone's saying, David Bowie never wanted a movie made, but they're making a movie of it and how disgusting it is. You watch this Shirley Jackson film and you just go, this isn't real. And you read the synopsis and it's like, no, it's all like made up by a screenwriter. And yet it's a thing where, because she's not terribly famous, I feel like this will become fact. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
More likely that people know what happened to Bruce Lee. And they know about David Bowie. And this has had this thing as well where I read after I saw it that I think Shirley Jackson's kids are like, I really don't like the way that their parents have been portrayed in the film. And I read it and went, I totally get that. Well, I watched it more like, there's been no fuss about this whatsoever. And yet it feels much more the case than those other films I mentioned.
Well, it's like
so obviously fictional, do you know what I mean? Because if you don't know the person that much and you're watching a drama about them, you'd assume that this must be true. But I was watching it, just felt, this feels like nonsense.
That's the danger of films, really. Is stuff like U571, where it's kind of like they rewrote it so it was the Americans that stole the Enigma code. And it was kind of like, fine, it's a film. It's a fictionalized version of accounts, but it's based on a true... Why would you make those changes? Why wouldn't you just... And I think that... I don't know if it's worse, but it's kind of like when you're dealing with an actual historical figure who you're kind of like shining a light on their life, you sort of like owe it to them. If you're gonna make something out of their name and their legacy, you sort of owe it to them to try and get it as right as possible, I think.
I just think it's odd that it seems to be not controversial in a way that those other films have been controversial, when it feels like this, this almost feels more important to do it because it's not someone who is super famous already. Whereas, I think most people that would see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood who know any of the real people involved would know that isn't... They would understand very swiftly that this is a fictionalised idea of them.
Well, I think a lot of people thought that the entire thing was made up, which was sort of like the dangerous thing about that film.
Yeah.
But... I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that film, but I do know that I liked about 90% of it, and then I hated the ending. But anyway, so The Invisible Man is incredible. I just thought it was really creepy, an amazing like central performance. I thought it was genuinely scary. And when you watch it, you're sort of like retrospectively even more embarrassed for the Tom Cruise Mummy movie, where kind of like, how did you fuck that up so badly? It had like a tenth of the budget and it basically focused on, well, let's just make a really low budget, creepy kind of horror movie. Mm. And they just knocked it out of the park. I think it's brilliant. There was a lot of people saying it's kind of like written for the Me Too generation. There's like a backlash of it then. But it's kind of like the film is about an invisible man who goes crazy and murders people. That is what that is the concept of the film and the story. The original story is that, and that's what this film is. I just think it's brilliant.
I really like look at it. I haven't seen it yet, but it's on my list of things to watch. Oh, and I like it. It feels it should be very modern and things. And if you're going to do an old-fashioned story and have it contemporary, this is what people are talking about right now. Let's do a film that's based around the concept and put it in a situation of talking about what everyone's talking about now. Makes sense.
It's definitely the way that they should have gone with all of these Universal remakes. You just think, they're horror franchises, and so it's kind of like, I don't want an action adventure kids film made out of that sort of stuff. It's kind of like it is what it is, and so you should treat it the way it was intended. I don't want to have like a Tom Cruise action adventure thing. And for an action adventure thing, they already did it with Brendan Fraser. So it's just kind of like you haven't got a new take on it. It's kind of you haven't sort of like reinvented something. It's kind of like a pale imitation of something that was okay. It's 20 years ago now, which is fucking crazy, but it's still fresh in everyone's memory.
And it did feel really weird at the time that was what they did with it. Because it was, I guess it's for, there was a generation where that is what The Mummy is Brendan Fraser. But it felt weird that you were kind of getting what looked like a Tom Cruise remake of a Brendan Fraser film. Seemed absolutely insane, because it just felt, they're kind of B-movies as well, aren't they? And to have, like, Tom Cruise, the world's biggest movie star, starring in what looked to be a remake of a Brendan Fraser film.
It's crazy.
It looked mad.
It's crazy. And then they rip off stuff like American Werewolf in London in it, and you go, who's this for? Because if you're a fan of the genre, if you're a horror fan, you've definitely seen American Werewolf in London. And so to watch this, it felt like bullying. It was just kind of like, this is a huge multi-million dollar movie starring Tom Cruise, and he's gone around the playground and he's stolen everyone's sweets and he's going, no, they're mine. Do you know what I mean? It's just kind of like, there's jokes and stuff that were done much better 40 years ago in a smaller film, which is like cult status. And it's kind of a shame.
I mean, I really like the idea of that dark universe thing as it was unfolding, but it just killed it off immediately.
And you just think, oh, God, I mean, I like the idea of a dark universe, but I don't want another six movies like this. This is fucking terrible. Anyway, so what else did I see? On Halloween, I watched Reanimator and Braindead.
Oh, yeah.
And I kind of think that Reanimator is sort of like a perfect kind of Halloween film. It's funny, it's dark, and it's scary. It sort of like just ticks loads of boxes. I do really like that film. It's not like it's sort of similar-ish in tone to maybe like an Evil Dead 2, but it's not as good as Evil Dead 2. But it's really enjoyable, and Brain Dead just is so disgusting. But actually, it was a lot less disgusting than I remembered it. But it is still fucking absolutely disgusting, and it's weird watching it in the context that. It's Peter Jackson, and then he went on to do The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbits and all that other stuff, because you kind of like, you watch it and you go, where's that filmmaker gone? And then I hadn't ever seen Bride of Reanimator, so I watched Bride of Reanimator, which is a really odd film, because it doesn't really have a story, and they're kind of like, every single scene is very weirdly paced and stilted. And in the original, there's sort of like a lot of campy performances, but in Bride of Reanimator, there were actually some bad performances. And they set stuff up that never gets paid off. Like there's a bit near the end where the syringe smashes on the floor, and there's a big close-up of the syringe that's smashed on the floor, and you think that's going to come back at some point, and it never does. And so it just feels like sort of like an unfinished film. And the ending sort of comes out of nowhere. I was sort of disappointed. But there's another one called Beyond Reanimator, which I haven't seen either, and that is next on my sort of list to see. And then, I was sort of disappointed with Bride of Reanimator. I bought it on DVD years and years ago, and I never sort of like got through it. And then to actually sit down and sort of like force myself to watch it, I was kind of like, it's not very good. That's probably why I've never sort of like got beyond like the first 10 minutes. And there's this like weird bit where they're in kind of like South America during this civil war. And it's kind of like the prologue. And that goes absolutely nowhere. It's like it's never referenced again. They end up working back at the same hospital from the original. It's kind of weird. It sort of steals the structure a little bit from Bride of Frankenstein, where she turns up for like the last 10 minutes at the end of the film. You think Bride of Frankenstein is going to all be about the Bride of Frankenstein, but in actual fact, she just pops up right at the end and then kills herself. And Bride of Reanimator sort of, they make a little bit more out of the Bride of Reanimator, but not a lot more. So she's in it for like maybe 20 minutes at the end. It's a weird one. I mean, I don't really recommend it, but I'm going to go and watch Beyond Reanimator because it was a belated sequel. It was made like in the 2000s. So I'll give that a go. And then the other thing I saw yesterday, I was making the most out of the fact that it's our last chance to do anything for a while. And I went to watch Lost Boys at Prince Charles Cinema.
Oh, yeah.
And it's basically, I looked around to see what was on, and it was the only thing that was kind of like, that I really fancied. I think Tenet, by the end of the year, will probably be the most lucrative film of all time. It's just in the cinema.
Me too. I think that's the way they had to think about it. It's just, I think it was mad that the cinemas and the distributors pulled everything, because I just think Tenet's just, it's the only thing in the cinemas still.
Still. IMAX, still at IMAX, still at Cinema Over the Road, still at all of the cinemas in central London.
And throughout the country.
It's the only thing to watch. It's the only thing to fucking watch. You're going, when they give the Oscars out, it's going to go to Tenet and the Trolls movie. It's like those are the only two things that are fucking...
Yeah, I think it's that way of going, oh, it's done really badly because it's opening weekended badly. And it's like, well, of course it did, because it can only possibly have 40% of capacity in every screen anyway because of social distancing. But rather than think about it like that, you've got this idea that the tail on it is huge because it's still playing. It opened in August and it's still playing in November.
It's fucking mental.
It's the only game in town.
It's mental. But anyway, so I saw Lost Boys, which I've always sort of liked, but I've never kind of like thought about it beyond that. It's kind of a cult film that people bring up. It's like one of those 80s films that, you know, that I think that it's got more of a reputation than it has maybe a fan base. And I watched it yesterday. I thought it was absolutely fucking incredible. I think it's a brilliant film. I think it's really clever. It's like this multi-generational kind of film. It's kind of like, it's a comedy, it's a teen movie. You've got two brothers. One of them's kind of like the big brother, Jason Patrick, and then you've got Corey Haim, who's the little brother. And then you've got the mum, Diane Wiest, and that's all three of them moved to like a new place. And you see it from the young brother's point of view, the teenage brother's point of view, and the mum's point of view, where all three of those storylines all get brought together in the last act of the film. And it's kind of, I think that it's genius because it's sort of like, you could see it as kind of like a metaphor for drug abuse, you know, where the brother becomes a vampire. And you see how it affects the mum and how he starts treating his mum and how he starts treating his little brother. And then the little brother is trying to save his big brother and the mum is trying to date. And it's just, I just think that I think I've probably seen it in bits over the years. And I've seen it edited for ITV or something with adverts in. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I've ever sort of like, I know I had it on VHS. I don't know how many times I've sat through and watched it from beginning to end. I haven't seen it in maybe 15 years.
Yeah.
I think this is the first time I've ever sort of like, well, maybe because I'm older. But it's
like one of the first times. And I hadn't seen it in years and years. And I read up about it because something seemed a bit odd about it. And apparently it was written to be for younger kids.
Right.
And it was like, and when you think of it that way, I went, oh, right, that obviously started life to be a bit like a Goonies or something, and it has that kind of, again, it feels a bit more adult because it ended up being rewritten to be for like older teenagers, but it does still have those trappings, I think, of being a slightly younger kids movie, and I guess you get that through the Corey Haim character. So yeah, like I say, yeah, it's multi-generational, isn't it? It's got that kind of,
it definitely has, because you've got Corey Feldman in it as well, so it definitely has sort of like that Goonies vibe. Mm. But it also manages to be a teen sort of drama about falling in with the wrong crowd. And Diane Wiest is so good in that film. You know, she had like this period in the late 80s, early 90s, where she was just sort of like doing, she was working with Woody Allen a lot. And then obviously she was in Edward Scissorhands, which she's incredible in.
Parenthood, she's great in that.
Parenthood, where she's playing mums, but they're all very different mums, you know. And yeah, she's just absolutely incredible. And Kiefer Sutherland is in it for like 10 minutes. Like, he's hardly in the film. And he's brilliant in it. Like, it's just, I just thought it was so much better than I remembered. And it really holds together as a film. And the fact that it's doing three things all at once and it ties together so neatly at the end, it's just sort of like, and it's Joel Schumacher who, obviously, will forever, he died this year. He'll forever have his CV stained with Batman and Robin. But, I mean, he did make some really great films. And I think maybe Lost Boys is...
Well, I guess he's sort of responsible more than most directors are for a lot of that kind of 80s teen movies, isn't he?
Well, he did St. Elmo's Fire.
Yeah.
He did, which was sort of like, St. Elmo's Fire was the one where it brought in pretty much every single member of the Brat Pack in one movie. And then, you know, Lost Boys. It's not a great film, but Lost Boys is brilliant. Falling Down is incredible. You know, so he's. I think that I've kind of like underestimated Lost Boys, but I just thought it was absolutely fantastic. And it just really, really holds up, Nat. And I really thoroughly enjoyed it. It was one of my nicest experiences that I've ever had at the Prince Charles, probably because it was half full. And I think, but it was weird because how, you know how rowdy those audiences are.
Yeah.
And like, I felt like I was the person in the cinema that enjoyed it the absolute most.
Yeah.
Like I was often the only person laughing during the comedy bits, you know. And you kind of like, and nobody booed the special effects, which is good, but the special effects hold up really well. But like, I don't know, I just thought it was like...
Just laughing at bits for no reason and sort of loudly laughing and...
Well, I felt like I was the annoying prick today. And I was just like, oh, that's a shame.
Last time I was at Prince Charles. It's obviously a thing that... Because it is, I think it's a shame that they do attract that kind of audience. Last time I was there, it even had like a warning beforehand. Like, there was a little trailer saying... Don't be a prick when you're watching these films.
Yeah,
it's obviously because other people have said it.
It's from Cape Fear. They do the Max Cady bit. They do the bit when Max Cady is laughing with a cigar, and they show that, and then it says, "Don't be Max Cady." And yeah, it's funny, but like it's true. I mean,
it's good. I mean, I'm glad they've done that because it obviously shows that the people who run it are aware that a lot of their audience get annoyed at people.
Yeah, but I've seen that trailer, and it's still been an unplayable gig. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I've seen that trailer and still had to walk out of a screening because it was so annoying. But yeah, there you go. Anyway, so it's time to do some fan mail. I've got some fan mail this week. So Brian, are you ready to do your fan mail?
Yes, I'm all right. I can't. I'm not feeling myself today.
Okay. The laryngitis or something.
Did you know what? This is the first time I've spoken all day. You know what? You know what it's like. The first time you speak all day and you're kind of like, is that what I sound like? Oh, it's taking me a bit place to play. Not feeling myself today, so bear with me as I get through the plan.
Of course,
Okay. So, dear Nick, Nat, Brian...
And Christopher.
You berated me last week for not asking anything deeper than how you're doing. This is a very slow way of having a conversation with someone, isn't it? You berated me last week for not asking anything deeper than how you're doing. So to make amends, here's a question for each of you. Brian, what is your favourite Christopher Lee film and why?
Christopher, what is your favourite AC/DC album and why?
Nick, what is your favourite Hammer film and why? Nat, what is your favourite Alice Cooper album and why? Cheers, John. Dumpa.
I think the problem John's done this week is he's asked too many questions.
Too many questions, John. Come on, man. I like The Man with the Golden Gun because I love a bit of Bond, mate.
Do you? I think it's a bit overrated.
Oh, no, I love a bit of Bond. Literally the only Christopher Lee film, other than the Draculas, that I could think of off the top of my head. And so, Christopher, what is your favourite AC/DC album of mine?
Well, of course, Brad, I like all of your albums. My favourite of yours would probably have to be The Best of AC/DC.
Well, that's a bit surprising because you are into your music there, Chris. Because I know that you've recorded several heavy metal albums of your own.
That's right.
Plus, you guessed it on the Hollywood Vampires album, which I do a track on. So I find it actually a little bit disrespectful.
You've got it disrespectful. I just prefer your... to me, it is the best.
Fine. Fair enough. Nick, what is your favourite Hammer film and why?
I like The Nanny. I think that's really creepy. And aside from that, I'm not really into Hammer, but I like Hammer. What was the one that I saw? No, I'm going to stick with The Nanny. I can't think of any. 1 million years BC, was that Hammer?
Yeah,
I like that. I like Raquel Welch and stop motion dinosaurs.
Who doesn't?
Come on.
And then, so, yeah, what's your favourite Alice Cooper album? Nat.
Favourite Alice Cooper album? I don't know, really. Do you know what? I've always quite liked Alice Cooper, but knew him mainly as a sort of singles person and knew his sort of hits. And I've always been quite fond of him. I would say that since doing this, I'm always surprised, never follow it up, by the breadth of stuff he's doing. And there's been lots of stuff that I've really liked. So I suspect it's probably something I haven't discovered properly yet.
An absolutely pathetic answer. Okay, so, moving briskly on. Hello, I'm a listener in Finland and think your show is mighty fine. Would you be interested in coming to our annual wife-carrying contest when it resumes next year?
Fingers crossed.
I have an attic you could lie in, thank you.
Kitos?
Elias.
Afternoon.
I've started watching a show called Swedish Dicks on Netflix. It stars Peter Stormare and Keanu Reeves. I think you should watch it and tell us about it next week. Nasi.
Okay.
Maybe.
Hello. I'm not sure when you will read this out. Now. Or maybe you won't care to. I remember ages ago on your show you were talking about romping. I really miss you talking about it and doing it. When will we be able to have a carefree romp again? Declan's bees. I love Treasure Island.
Okay. Oh,
that's nice. I like Treasure Island. Do you mean the book, the film, or the place?
Good question.
Good question. Maybe you could clarify that next week, Declan Pease. Okay, great. Well, let's play a song and then we'll get our guest on.
Collapse and love.
Tom and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're off. We're back again. Oh, God. Here we are, live. We're not live. We're pre-recorded from the studio. We're not in the studio. I'm in my living room, and Nathaniel is in his washroom. And we're now joined with our guest for today, comedian, actor, writer, and producer, Janet Varney. Hello, Janet. How are you doing?
Hello. I'm very well. I'm so torn between staring at almost nothing behind Nathaniel and everything behind you, Nick. I mean, there's a lot of what a trove back there. I really want to rifle through everything like a raccoon.
You've got some very impressive wallpaper, Janet, behind you.
This is a curtain.
A curtain.
This is just a
A
curtain to this is very like Wizard of Oz. Behind me is I don't know what's on the. If I'm the wizard, I guess on the other side is where Dorothy and Toto and the gang are. So
yes, you're controlling it all.
I'm controlling it all, always, okay. And by all I mean I control all everything that's happening right now.
Okay,
I'm glad someone's
responsibility.
I'm glad someone's in charge.
To be honest, that's a welcome relief.
Yeah, let's not talk about who's in charge on the day after Election Day in America.
Okay. How are you feeling about that?
Awful.
Yeah.
Just awful.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's not over yet, but it's, you know, I don't know how many times this country has to be told, you know, the polls seemed actually off for some reason. It's very surprising. Like, oh, no, did we not learn that polls mean nothing? But.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I'm really worried that Trump won't win, but my fingers are crossed, and hopefully we'll have another great 4 years. Okay.
It's stressful watching it from England, so where are you?
Thanks for caring. I'm in Los Angeles.
You're in Los Angeles. Right. And you've been up for a couple of hours already. It's 8 o'clock, 8 o'clock in the morning where you are, 4 o'clock in the
Indeed.
Afternoon where we are, and you've been up for a couple of hours. You're an early riser, you just said.
Bit of an early riser, didn't used to be true, but quarantine encouraged me to get out into the world before everyone else because I like a little solitude in a morning walk, and that was becoming harder and harder to get. So, and I strongly approve of people getting exercise, so I don't resent people for going out and wandering around in the streets of Los Angeles, but I liked a little more solitude.
As in space.
That's right. I would say that tips a little too far into too much solitude for me. If we're looking at the scale, the space to crowded streets. It's Shibuya Crossing in Japan and space here, I'm probably right in the middle.
Okay, of course. Yeah, of course. You do have quite a lot of space in Los Angeles anyway, I suppose.
Yes. We are. It's a sprawl, but I live right near Griffith Park, which is a very large space for hiking, and it makes a huge difference for me.
Do you live on the outskirts?
I live. I have a view of the Hollywood sign from my house, which is not a perk, if especially on a bad day in the business. If you come home feeling like everyone's against you, and then you look up, it just feels like you're living a satire.
But when you first moved in, was it like, well, incredible, I've made it?
Nope. I moved to Los Angeles more cynical than I am now. I've become less cynical as my career has maintained itself. So I would say it was even worse when I moved in. I was like, whoa, boy, how quickly can the ivy bushes grow upward? And the answer is fairly quickly. And I have to really crane my neck to see now the sign if I want to.
I don't feel like a particularly positive person, but I feel I'd be like, lifting my top hat and up and down or something every time I saw a Hollywood sign outside my window.
I got to get a top hat. I don't know why I have not brought that into circulation for an everyday thing so I can tip it at the Hollywood sign. That's probably why I'm not as optimistic. If I had that top hat, it probably affects the level of oxygen that goes to the brain. I would be euphoric.
Nathaniel doesn't have a top hat. You don't own a top hat.
No, I don't own a top hat. You're right.
You'd have to buy one specifically to do that.
I would if I lived within sight of the Hollywood sign. My view is depressing.
Have you ever been to the La Brea Tar Pits?
Yes. Oh, yes. I said that so enthusiastically. You'd think that I spent all my time there. No, I have. It's really interesting. That's a strange, great middle of Los Angeles reminder that dinosaurs roamed just where you're standing waiting for your call back to start. So that's a nice reminder that everything is meaningless in a really good way, actually.
Yeah. It's a good...
Have you been?
Yeah, I did. Well, I mean, but the reason I went is kind of pathetic because they're sort of featured in the movie Last Action Hero. And and when I went to Los Angeles, I was just like, oh, I'll go to that place where all the tar is from Last Action Hero. And right. And it's nothing like it is in the film. It's a good afternoon, I thought. I really enjoyed it. I loved it. But it's weird because Los Angeles feels sort of like it's very business orientated, isn't it? And it feels like there's sort of a lack of culture. And then, like you say, you go to this place where there's tar and they've got all of these fossilized dinosaur bones that have been there for millions and millions of years. And it's kind of like, yeah, it's like this oasis of history in this place, which is all very new.
Yeah. And then you have the art museum right next to it where there's, I mean, it's a strange strip that on Wilshire Boulevard right there because, yeah, you have like, I feel like it's not just a modern art museum. So you have like, you know, historical cave. I don't know. Do we go all the way back to cave drawings? Probably not. But, you know, the great Dutch masters and so forth. And then like weird modern sculptures and dinosaur bones. And then the SAG Screen Actors Guild office is just a hop, skip and a jump away from that. So it is. It's a strange city. I would say I was very reluctant to move here. I did not have, you know, I lived in San Francisco, which is arguably one of the more European cities, if there are any at all in America, you know, just a sort of tightly packed, culturally diverse, little small test city where you can really see when something passes and doesn't go well or does go well. There's this sort of immediate reaction that everyone feels. But I loved all of that. And so coming to LA, I had started to get work and I was really reluctant, but now I love living here and I actually wouldn't go back to San Francisco. And I think where the culture exists is in pockets. Like it's in pockets of neighborhoods and there's a ton of culture and a ton of multiculture in Los Angeles. You just kind of have to know where to go because otherwise you sort of do, I think you get stuck with a veneer of, you know, LA, mm-hmm. capital L, capital A. What does that even mean? Where am I? You know?
Hmm. How do you find the business at the moment?
I've been really lucky. I was on a show that was shooting when we shut down and we were able to go back to work in September and finish out our season. So I just finished that last week, going in and rehearsing in a K95 mask, and everyone in the crew had like a face goggles or their own glasses, a face shield, and a K95 mask, and they never took them off anywhere on the set. And then the actors would do everything in a mask, and then, you know, when they called action, you sort of take off the mask, somebody comes and quickly tries to, you know, get the red smear, yeah. That whatever, the like chafing of your face fixed, and then we would shoot. And it was certainly different and hard because you don't get to just sort of hang out with people when you're not rolling, because there is a sort of social distancing. It was very, very responsible and very sanitized. But it was really nice to go into work again. You know, it felt, I've been able to do some voiceover stuff, and a lot of live streaming stuff from home. And I am very much kind of a homebody. So I love where I live and I like nesting. But even so, getting, you know, going into work and seeing people and like, hi, we're in person together. Well, oh my gosh, there's so many of you. It started to feel like a luxury just to be in a room and look around and go like, oh my gosh, there's 20 people in here. This is what a village we have here. It was nice. It really was like, oh yeah, social creatures make sense. Sure. Like our hearts are calling out for this. That's a real thing, you know?
I think I found that. I think of myself as being very much a homebody and someone that likes my own company. I never get bored. I've got stuff to do. I'm always, you know,
You're always decorating your walls, etc.
But I think this has really made me think, do you know what? I do actually like people. I forget that it's really nice to go out and see people.
You want to know it's your choice. You want to be invited to the party, feel like you'd be welcome there, and then promptly say yes and then immediately cancel, or, you know, just say no to begin with. But the point is, it's happening. Sure. Your people are out there. Yeah. And then you don't go. That's like me.
Yeah. Or I can show up early doors and then sneak off quite early.
Oh, don't you just love that? It's wonderful. Oh, yeah. You get the one-on-one time with a host, a lot of meaningful eye contact, and then just, oop, I heard a noise outside, and then I went home.
I attend parties like I'm trying to establish an alibi for a murder. I make sure everyone's seen me. They've all seen me there. Afterwards, I go, I was there.
I'm totally stealing that bit. That's genius. Yeah, very much so.
The last party you went to, Nat, was my party. Okay, right. I would say at the beginning of lockdown, when everything was being cancelled, was kind of like my favourite part of it, which was just kind of...
Oh, really?
Like, I had a tour, and I was getting very anxious and nervous about having to go on tour, and then it was just like, oh, that's been delayed by a year. You go, oh, a year, that's a year away. And now it's like 3 months away. And it's like, well, that year's gone by really quickly. I've got to get nervous again. So,
do you think that the tour within 3 months, do you think we'll be in a place where that goes ahead as planned?
No. I don't think so.
But look, you're going to be just fine.
I get that, though.
There was a sense of, I have a podcast, and I was talking to Colin Mochrie. Do you know who that is?
Oh, yeah.
He's a great improviser. And he was on two different tours when it happened. And, you know, he's just like the most humble, gracious, you know, self-effacing, quiet person when he's not on stage. In fact, he calls his stage persona the other, because he's so kind of embarrassed by the person he turns into when he's improvising. But he was like, you know, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to say this is a good thing. Of course, it's very bad thing. But I did get to go home and spend time with my family, and you know, what a gift! So he definitely felt that sort of initial, like, oh, so I can't go, I can't be stressed out. I really have to just. I definitely relate to that.
You've had some amazing guests on your podcast, haven't you?
I have. Yeah, I've been lucky to be. I think the comedy community is very welcoming in terms of stuff like that, because my podcast I've been doing for about 8.5 years. So there weren't a ton of podcasts then, even though I remember thinking almost 9 years ago, like, oh, I can't start a podcast. Everybody has a podcast, and how wrong I was. But I think because people who are in the kind of alt comedy world, but also I'm sure the more mainstream, it's just not as much of what I dip a toe into. Everybody's a self-starter. Everyone understands what it feels like to want to have something going on that's yours, that you're not waiting for the phone to ring, to be able to do what you do. And so I think there's a lot of support there for peers who, you know, who go, oh yeah, okay, sure. You got a thing. I know what it feels like to have a thing and want someone to do it. You know, yeah, I'll make time for that. So I've been really lucky in that regard.
And you've been maintaining doing, it's called the JV Club, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you've been maintaining that through lockdown or through the pandemic?
Yeah, that was another thing that, so many people had to figure out technology in a way that they hadn't before. And even me, I remember thinking like, I'm in pretty good shape. You know, I record my podcast from home. People come over to me. You know, I have the gear. I kind of know what to do. And then I got a cartoon job that was going to record every week. And when I got the sort of rundown of what they needed of me in terms of the quality of what I could do, I realized very quickly that I was in over my head. But many people were sort of, you know, buying microphones like very quickly and you know, with a sense of urgency and learning how to do stuff. So I have not had a problem at all. In fact, I was ahead, not perhaps surprisingly. I was like, oh, I've never had so many episodes banked. Like, no one has anything going on except to do these. So here we are. Like, I was for the first time having to say to people, because I typically only interview men over the summer. It's just when I started the podcast, I was just interviewing women because there weren't a lot of women in podcasting in general. And then I expanded about a year in, year or two into my, what I call my Boys of Summer series. And I realized like in June that I had more episodes with great men than I could. I was already stretching past into September. And I had to say, I know it's the beginning of summer, but somehow I can't interview this person because I don't have room. And now I'm totally not, I mean, I have, you know, one episode for this week and immediately I'm, you know, who am I recording next? Ha 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 ha, or I won't get it done in time. So that was short-lived.
In the before times, we used to record in a studio. And now I love the idea of not having to go to a studio and just staying in my white-walled cell of a room that I live in and not have to travel. I find this a real advantage.
But also it's had like a knock-on effect. I mean, we get to talk to people like you in Los Angeles and all over the world, really. And it's kind of like before it was kind of like, who's available on a Friday?
Sure. Absolutely. No, I agree. It absolutely made that possible for me as well. I was talking to somebody, I mean, because I was like you, and I could have done more of this since I was doing it from home, but I liked the, you know, let's be on a sofa together. Let's, you know, I want to be able to have meaningful eye contact or not worry about cutting the other person off. And sometimes when I do just phone interviews, there is that overspeak where somebody, well, yeah, okay. Why don't you go ahead? You know, there is that sort of stumbling, but once you speak to somebody who's in Ireland, you know, there is a real sense of like, ooh, I'm really stretching my wings here. Maybe it's worth a stumble or two to make this happen, you know?
And on top of that, so you're the co-founder and creative director of Sketchfest, which is based in San Francisco.
Yes. Yeah.
And you've had some absolutely
not happening in January.
Not happening. I don't know whether I would have done Edinburgh this year. I think I would have come off quite before, and then maybe I'd have done work in progress in Edinburgh and sort of tried to come up with another show to tour next year. I don't know. Everything's different now. Yeah. It keeps going on and on and on. You know, the coronavirus. You know, I think originally it was like it's 2 weeks. And everyone's like, okay, we can deal with 2 weeks. And now it's like, well, it's probably going to be 2 years. If not, or maybe this is just how it is now. And so it's kind of the technological side of it has really sort of like meant that, you know, we're having to relearn what our job is, or get used to a new way of doing things, which might be more permanent than we thought. And so,
what is it like in Los Angeles? Are you what are you allowed to do, and what are you not allowed to do currently?
Good question. I'd love to hear also from you about what it's been like there. I would like to say that, like, I remember the first month or two, all the reports were, and this is before the fires, you know, the air in Los Angeles is better than it's literally ever been on record. And there was just, you know, if you were walking down the street, and many of us were, I mean, that was the thing I turned to the most quickly, was just like, put a mask on, get out there, wander around, so get out of the house. There was no traffic. And that is a huge piece of what makes Los Angeles, Los Angeles. And so that was extraordinary. Like, I live in the hills. And so looking back out at the city, it was just crystal clear. You know, you can see all the way to the ocean, which is a fair distance from where I live. And there was something kind of magical about it. And people, and for a while they were so worried about the virus that they closed the trails in the park, which I was very upset about. But it's true that people were just huffing and puffing, not wearing masks, like on these tiny trails, sort of breathing onto each other. But for the couple, even like the 2 or 3 weeks that they closed those, there were all these reports of, you know, the deer population is recent, you know, like the coyotes are, like, there was a lot of sort of nature watching happening. And all of that was kind of, you know, I think so many of us have that fascination with the apocalypse that, you know, you kind of, a little hint of that sort of sort of thrilling, like, ooh, all the bunnies have taken the trails back over because they're not afraid of people's dogs. Like, ooh, it's the end of the world. Wait, it's the end of the world. But now, you know, restaurants are open. I don't know how much indoor seating there is, but we have not had to lock back down to the point where everything's just takeout or anything like that. I see people, lots of seating outside. The weather's temperate, you know, so that's not in November. We're about to have like a 91 degree day, which is ghastly. But for the most part, you know, it's in the 70s, it's in the 60s. And like I said, I was able to go back to work. So it certainly feels more normal than it did. And part of that has included, like, traffic feels kind of normal again. You sort of go, oh, okay, I guess we're up and running enough that suddenly everyone's in their car again, which is not great. But how about with you?
Well, at midnight tonight, we enter lockdown 2. We're going back into lockdown.
Yeah.
For a second. Well, apparently just for a month, but we shall see whether we are just for a month. As Nick says,
just two weeks.
Yeah, I think it was. I think I remember people going, it's 3 weeks, then we'll be back. It's almost like it's a great way of introducing a pandemic to people, though, I think. Very much giving them, we were told very early on, it's fine. We're basically staying indoors for 3 weeks. And just catch up on all your TV shows and things. It's a little opportunity for everyone. And then after 3 weeks, it just kind of kept going. And everyone started wondering whether, is it 3 weeks or is it?
Yeah.
I feel like we've been here a lot longer than 3 weeks.
How's the, I mean, I'm sure I read about this, but how is the sort of like social support, like government support of the economy, you know, in terms of like one of the problems here, as I'm sure you know, is that just so much back and forth about, you know, how much support can people be given in this time? How, you know, what's possible? How bad is the unemployment rate going to get? And then you look at some place like Denmark, right, who I believe just continued to make sure everyone got paid something. And because it's such a small world that, you know, such an insular country that they were like, oh, yeah, we'll shut down entirely. But you won't even notice it in the bank, in your bank account. Like, there, you know what I mean? Where does the UK
fall? Well, a lot of people were furloughed. So a lot of people were given 80% of their earnings that were paid for by the government.
Gotcha.
Which was handy. But if you were self-employed, there was a whole other system that was based on, a lot of people didn't seem to qualify, even though they absolutely should have qualified and could say, I'm entirely self-employed. So there's lots of funny rules like that. Some people haven't earned any money. Some people are lucky enough to be able to do things online and things. But there's a lot of work. There's certainly, like, the live comedy world is gone, virtually. Mm. It's that kind of... and lots of people trying to do gigs in that way that feels very, well, let's put on a show right here. But ultimately, when you see it, it looks like some weird Mad Max Transformers universe of people trying to put on gigs in junkyards and
we've been doing drive-in comedy gigs where people turn up in a car park and sit in their cars and then someone tells jokes at the front of this car park and then if people like the jokes they beat their horns and you go, fuck that, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that.
I didn't know that the beeping was going to be happening.
It's like,
that sounds awful.
Yeah, but also,
I think I'd rather just kind of see through the reflection whether they're chuckling or not and not hear anything at all than hear beeping. That's so jarring. Like,
we all want a gig again, but not like that. Come on. And because we're in the arts, the government came up with a poster campaign last week where we were all told, what's the name of the girl? It's a ballerina called Fatima.
Oh, Fatima.
Yeah. So
well, I think that was turned out not to be, that was an old thing in the end, I think.
It was an old thing, was it? Yeah. Oh, well, it resurfaced and everyone in the arts was told to retrain in, what was it, in cyber. They said, be like Fatima and retrain in cyber. And it was this little girl putting on ballet shoes. And she's like, what the fuck does retraining cyber mean? I mean, and so it feels like it's, maybe if it was an old thing, maybe it wasn't the worst timing ever, but it resurfaced at a time where it just felt like we're being kicked when we're down.
Mm. I think, you know, as much as things aren't great in the States, it does feel like our country's very much following suit in all of that. There just is no interest in the arts, other than it's what everyone's been watching for the last 8 months.
There's a disconnect there.
It's like, yeah, it's like what would you have done? What would you have done in the whole of lockdown if it wasn't for the arts? Like people would have got divorced and meltdowns, and you know, it's got people through it, and people think that it just appears out of nowhere, and it's kind of like, no, this is our job, you know.
Yeah. Do you find that everybody? I mean, the other part I would imagine is the anxiety. I mean, I don't do stand up, but the idea of coming up with new material, knowing that you're sort of having the exact same experiences as everybody else, and trying to think about, like, can I call back something from my youth that I haven't joked about yet? Because making a joke about something quarantine related feels like, how can you not feel hacky? Even if it's the most brilliant idea you've ever had, to think, but doesn't it, probably everyone is writing this same stuff, right?
Yeah. I think that if Edinburgh is possible to go ahead next year, they should probably not do it anyway and just give everyone a year just to have a life so that they've got something to write about. Because I'm just picturing like 1,000 stand-up shows, you know, that are all about lockdown, all about coronavirus, and you just think, fuck it. I mean, even if I've got an idea for a show, I probably don't even want to go up to Edinburgh and have to sit through anyone else's. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm finding writing stuff about actual stand-up, I'm finding that difficult, but that just means that I'm just sort of like working on like older ideas that are, you know, fiction, you know.
I think it's one of those things as well where it feels like it's absolutely the elephant in the room as well, where it'd almost be insane not to mention it. Right. Just go, hey, so who likes waffles? That's, which is my regular material, of course. Who likes waffles?
Because everybody likes waffles.
Yeah, yeah. But it just feels like such an odd time not to mention it. Especially if you're talking to, you know, essentially, you know, a car park full of Transformers who are sentient machines who are beeping at you and things.
But on the positive side of this, I was outside a few months ago and I saw a fox in the middle of the day.
This is what I'm talking about. I live in a neighborhood where there's such a celebration of the mountain lion that has survived in this region and has kind of a wide territory. Its name is P22. So very, very personal name. But it's so ingrained in us now that P22 feels like its name might as well be Basil. Like, oh, P22. And there's a P22 day that happens in Griffith Park every year. And P22 has absolutely been exploring neighborhoods, much more often than not. And everybody has like a ring cam or, you know, some sort of security camera in this area. So there are just these posts in these community forums of people's, you know, weird burglar footage of this stalking mountain lion, you know, walking past their Tesla.
So it's one specific mountain lion.
Yeah, because there can only be one. It's the Highlander of the Griffith Park, but its territory stretches across freeways. So that's one of the reasons that people are so astonished by it, is that, you know, getting across the 405 freeway, if you're a wild animal, seems unlikely at best, but it somehow traverses.
It's like its own pride of lions, or it's one single lion that everyone's seeing?
It's one single lion that everyone's seeing.
Is everyone seeing the same guy? The same guy is...
Everyone's seeing the same guy. It's it's a real celebrity sighting.
Wow. Does that sort of bring together a sense of community then?
Yeah. It does. It really does. Because also, you know, I don't know if you have, do you have something like, we have something here called Nextdoor, which is this app, or, you know, you can certainly do it on your computer, but it exists in app form as well, where you sign up and you start getting alerts from various, you know, if like, okay, this is your, oh, you do. Natalie says we do have that. You do have that. So, you know, what it ends up being is like, the idea is great, and you see a lot of really lovely sort of like, I have a bunch of extra mulch that I don't need. Does anyone, like, that's what you want to think it is all the time, but it's also a place for people to attack each other, get into like politics and, you know, there's a lot of like crime mongering. There's, you know, there's a lot of crimes worse now than it ever was. And you sort of go, well, is it, or am I just hearing about your car being broken into? Because there was no way I would ever have heard about that since you live 3 miles from me. You know, why would I have known that if it weren't for this place where all this information is being pooled? So there's, you know, it just degenerates quickly, I think, into, a lot of like, you know, someone's like, well, the homeless situation is so out of control. Well, if you understood better how the economy is, blah, 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 well, I don't know. You listen, you and your voting is really what's ruined this city. Like, there's just a lot of that. So when it's something as simple as, you know, I saw a fox in the middle of the street, or P-22 came past my car, people are like, oh, this is great. Yeah.
Feels like there's a big difference between a fox, which I can imagine. I think if I saw a lion go past my window now, I really would think it was the end of the world. I think I'd be absolutely terrified.
Yeah, yeah.
Terrifying?
It is a little terrifying.
Okay.
But nobody ever seems to get attacked. But there are also a lot of coyotes, and there absolutely have been, you know, people's cats go, you know, they vanish, and people's small dogs disappear from time to time, and that's, I guess, the agreement that you make when you live. And coyotes are everywhere in Los Angeles. So that already is, you know, you will see a coyote trotting across, you know, the La Brea tar pits in the afternoon from time to time. And it's like, oh, okay, well, we all have to live together, I guess.
But what's the coyote's relationship to the mountain lion?
I think they just stayed out of each other's way. I don't know that I think they're both eating deer, but probably there are smaller animals that the coyotes end up with, including pets.
So they don't, you don't, it's not like the coyotes are the bad guys. And then you've got kind of like this mountain lion, which is kind of like protecting everyone, like some sort of superhero.
Like some sort of the Lion King movie. Yeah, no, I don't think so. I don't think so. It's a real ecology out here. But it's cool. I mean, I love that stuff. I do. Same thing with bobcats. We have also bobcats, smaller, shorter tail. There's lots of those sightings because there can be more bobcats per capita, I guess, in a territory. But yeah, I mean, I love all of that. That's all stuff that I really wanted to live in a place where I could, you know, leave my house on foot and within 10 minutes kind of not really see that much of the city and feel like I was intermingling with other critters.
Yeah, I guess, I don't know if that is a cultural difference, whereas I just think a lion to me is so exotic and mad that I would never, the idea of one being around.
Right.
But it's a mountain lion, Nathaniel.
Sure.
Yeah, it's not, not like, yeah,
a,
it's not.
Not like a lion off the plains of Africa. It's like, it's a mountain lion.
The
confusing thing about mountain lions is that they have a bunch of different names that are all legit, like a puma or a cougar. I think like those are all the same.
Okay.
Puma is a cougar, is a mountain lion.
Okay. Okay.
Does any one of those sound less? No, they all sound terrifying.
Sure. I guess a fox is just a different... It's literally a different breed.
I've never seen a fox in real life.
We get them all the time. But yeah. See one in the middle of the day that's sort of like walking down the street going like, all right. You're like, whoa, you're brave. All right, fine.
Yeah.
We're doing that now.
It's like you have a different idea of foxes. You don't have like, the foxes you see here don't tend to be like, it's not like Disney's Robin Hood. These ones look like they've had a hard life. A lot of them don't look like
that. Oh, they are. So they probably are more like coyotes, because coyotes definitely, you see some real cute ones and then you see some real snaggle tooths that have like mange. You sort of see like, oh, most of your fur is gone. Huh? That's disturbing.
Foxes also make the maddest sound, which is terrifying.
Yeah. There are a bunch of animals, it turns out, that make sounds that I somehow went my whole life without knowing what they sounded like porcupine. I only found out what a porcupine sounded like because of the internet like 3 years ago. I had no idea that porcupines make the sounds that they make.
What does a porcupine sound like?
It's like, there's a video out there of a porcupine eating some pumpkin, and it's like, I'm kidding. And it's been confirmed that that is, in fact, what a porcupine sounds like. Yum, 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 yum. Come on. How did we not know this?
This has been incredibly educational.
Right? Look at us. Look at us zoologists.
If you live in an area with a high fox population, you will think that, if your neighbours lived in an area with a high fox population, they would report that people were being murdered outside their houses every night. Because they just scream. Sure. They scream like, and it sounds like a human scream.
It's when they're having sex.
I believe it is when they're having sex.
I guess cats are like that too, right? I mean, even just alley cats are very scary when they're having sex. They sound very, very
absolutely
scary.
They scratch me.
Non-COVID related joke. Write it down. Here we come, Edinburgh.
I reckon I can get 5 minutes out of that.
For sure. Just ring it out.
Apparently foxes have barbed penises as well. They have like...
What so many animals do?
It seems unnecessary, right? I mean... Yeah.
It seems unnecessary. Yes.
Is necessary.
I guess so, but it's... Why make it... Why is it going to be harder than it needs to be?
I know. Awful.
Okay. So, Janet...
That got serious.
You're not a stand-up comedian, but you do improv and sketch comedy. Is that... So that's where you started out, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't... When I was... kid, I just took theater and stuff, and I shied away from any kind of improv team or anything comedy related, even though I loved... That was the stuff that I grew up with and loved. It was very much a what if I suck, like, you know, people saying, well, you're funny, you should... And I think that I was the kind of person who really thought, you know, better to always wonder if I would have been good at something than to try it and fail. And so I really shied away from that. And it wasn't until I was, you know, over 20 that, that even though I had done theater and stuff my whole life, just in school, I mean, I wasn't like a kid with an agent or anything like that, but, that I started doing improv and that is definitely what led to me kind of moving down to Los Angeles and stuff. I was just doing that stuff for fun. And then someone came and told me that I could make money doing it. And it was terrifying, but also exhilarating.
Was in the States then? Because I would say over here, maybe it's just a smaller world, but the sketch comedy world, the stand-up world, I guess perhaps because of the Edinburgh Festival, feels like it's a much more closed space. And very much adjacent to each other. So lots of people from one will do the other. And I guess somewhere like Edinburgh maybe more, has a community.
Yeah, I think that's... I don't know that that's what I find on a regular basis. I think here stand-up is definitely... There's certainly overlap. But I think I've even observed that in the UK there tends to be more crossover than in the States. There's a lot of, I only do stand-up, I could never do what you do, and oh, I only do improv, the idea of doing stand-up is terrifying. I think I hate saying the alt comedy world, but there is the most overlap there, I think. But it's still, there's still kind of a separation, a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a little bit of a separation here, but it does feel like, you know, it feels almost like they're... It feels like everyone's pals in a way.
Yeah.
There's a kind of... it feels like very much adjacent to each other. Do you think there's a divide anyway between sketch, stand-up and improv and things in the States? Do you think there's a more of a...
I mean, stand-up is just more universally desired by the public. You know, stand-up comedy clubs are prolific, and there's very little room to do... I mean, that's what I found in San Francisco when I was starting stuff. I was in a sketch troupe, and there was almost nowhere to do sketch. And if, you know, the comedy clubs are very welcoming, but then you go there and realize, like, oh, I... I have a wig change, and there's four of us, and four of us won't fit on this stage, so we shouldn't have confirmed this gig. And then audiences, like, you know, drunk bachelorette parties, were not, they did not want to see, you know, my take on, like, Mormon missionaries. They wanted one person to rapid-fire punchlines at them nonstop. And so, you know, that's kind of why we started the festivals, because we had met these other sketch groups that were kind of experiencing the same thing, but you had to rent a theater for a month in San Francisco, which is prohibitively expensive. And also, who wants to do their sketch? Like, what are you going to do? Seven shows a week doing your 45-minute, like, goofy, you know, mid-20s, early 20s, like, level, age level writing? No, you don't want to do that. So we got together with them, and we would have kind of, everybody got the chance to perform and do their set with someone else's. So we were kind of trying to pollinate audiences and just have a home where everybody could kind of do something together for a month. And that's what grew into the festival that we have now, which is sketch and improv and music and film tributes and, you know, TV panels and all that kind of stuff. But it very much had its roots in, well, shit, we can't perform anywhere. What do we do?
Because I mean, what I would say, I don't really agree with Nathaniel in terms of this cross pollination. What I would say was, stand up. The point of stand up is to sort of pretend that there aren't any conventions to it. You're trying to. It's like a magic trick where you're trying to convince the audience that you've just stepped on stage. You're just a regular guy, just like them. And you just stepped on stage and you're just talking off the top of your head. As soon as you bring in conventions like scenes, characters, costumes, everything like that, then it's kind of like, it's basically you're highlighting the fact that it is constructed, you know, that it's fake. And that's sort of the opposite of what stand-up is. But then if you're working in sketch and improv, you know, my favorite part of writing is work in progress, because I know that it can be different every single time I get up on stage until I've written the show, and then it's the same. And once the show is written, it's kind of like you're not going through the motions, but there is a point when you've been touring the same thing for like 3 months. By the end of it, you're like going, all right, I've only got five more shows to get through, and then we can move on. And sure. I think, so what do you prefer? Do you prefer, have you ever improvised something that's so good that you've gone, right, I'll write that down, and then that's become a sketch?
I think I thought that's going to be what was going to happen when I was taking improv and doing more sketch. But what kind of developed quickly was, just a laziness, that improv allows. Like, if you get good, and the idea is if you get good enough and if you do it often enough, you don't have to get anything ready at all, and you could just show up somewhere, and if it's good, you feel like a genius, and if it's bad, you can go, it was just an off night, you know, it just wasn't great, or you could blame it on the crowd or whatever. It is really the laziest version of comedy, because you, if you have these moments of genius, you know, again, I don't know that I've ever had one, but they're certainly as a group. And that's one of the things I love about it, and why I don't feel drawn to stand up is that I really love having people have my back. I think I do better when I'm surrounded by people who I think are funnier than I am. And also that if I have a moment where I'm sort of drawing a blank, that I'm working with a group of people with whom I have, you know, in whom I have utter confidence that we're going to save this thing together, and that I have no ego about that. I don't feel like, oh, that was a bad moment for me, and I stink because, you know, Hal had to come in and rescue me. It feels very much like a give and take, and that, you know, if you work with people long enough, everybody has the chance to have all of those different kinds of moments. And I love the trust of that. I mean, I really do. I'm such a nerd. I'm just a big, you know, nerd, hippie nerd. Like, the most improv I do now, I have two different groups. One I don't improvise with except for maybe once or twice a year, at Sketchfest, which is, like these just powerhouse, like John Michael Higgins and Michael Hitchcock, who are in all of Christopher Guest's films, Rachel Dratch from Saturday Night Live, Oscar Nunez from The Office, Simon Helberg when he can from Big Bang Theory, and they're just an amazing, amazing group. And I don't get to improvise with them often enough because we all kind of live in different places. But then I improvise with a group called the Work Juice Players, which is a sort of spin-off of this live and podcast show called the Thrilling Adventure Hour that I've been part of for almost 10 years. But it's filled with just phenomenal improvisers. You know, it's so lovely to be backstage with them and do just stupid. We don't do really warm ups, but just that moment before the show starts, I'm filled with such love for them. Like, oh, I love these people. That's where the high is for me. It's not even the audience, really. If I can see that I've done something that's inspired a person I think is brilliant and who cares about me, and that, you know, elicits some kind of response, that's just the best feeling. And so I don't know how I would do if I were by myself. I think I would probably burn out really quickly and like hate myself.
I had a similar experience one Edinburgh. In fact, I did a sketch show with some friends who were unsure whether they wanted to do it. I'd never tried to write sketches before. And I thought I'd write with them and we'd do this show. And we did it for 3 weeks. And I found exactly the same thing in that I thought it was so much easier because I always felt that even if the show was going badly, I didn't care as much because there was two other people having exactly the same experience. And yet at the end of it, I was like, nah, I'd much rather have a much worse time and have this like really, it felt like I was cheating or something. And at the end of it, yeah. I had this kind of like, oh, it was much nicer, like much nicer. And yet I at the end of it, it must be something masochistic or something. It's like, part of it is that I kind of hate it, is why I like it.
Yeah.
I think that makes sense.
I think that makes sense. I mean, I definitely feel, you know, like my friend, one of the people with whom I improvise quite regularly, at least we would do at least a once a month show before all this. And we have not. He's been doing more stuff online. I have not done any improvising online, but his name is Paul F. Tompkins, and he's one of the best stand-ups I've ever seen. I mean, I came into his life as a huge fan, and I was doing improv before he was, and then he started doing improv with the Work Juice Players, and of course was just immediately brilliant because he kind of had all the tools, whether he was actively, you know, working on them or not, they were happening. And he's so great. And he's a great example of somebody who I feel like can just walk between those worlds effortlessly. And, you know, he just has a great time doing both. But I don't know a ton of people who seem to have almost an equal relationship to each. And so there are a lot of conversations that happen among friends in comedy where, like I was saying before, like I say, I don't get why would you want to do that? I mean, I like being at home at night. If I could do shows maybe at brunch, like I, you know, but the sun goes down and the last thing I want to do is go to an open mic and, you know, try to have to do something for a bunch of times. Like everything you're talking about, Nick, about developing the show, that all makes perfect sense to me. And yet it sounds horrible.
Oh,
like it's like that all makes sense. And I still think, oh God, I don't need any more reasons to beat myself up. And I would find them all if I were doing that, you know?
I mean, the more I think about it, I go, it's horrible.
I find it terrifying. I find it terrifying. And also having this break from live performance, you only get rustier as it, you know, it takes about 2 weeks to get really rusty as a stand up. And this has been months, and it's kind of like the idea of getting up on stage is just terrifying. Last Edinburgh, I wrote a musical, and that was with five other people. And I did a stand-up show where I did an hour on my own, and I found that terrifying every single day. And then my musical was like this horror musical that was all creepy, and it was the happiest I've ever been on stage, to the point that I was smiling throughout the entire thing when we were meant to be kind of like creepy and everything. I just came out every day with this huge, massive. You can. We had an early recording where we recorded off the sound desk all of our microphones, and you can just hear me sort of like giggling at my microphone for the entire hour, like ruining the thing. But I loved it. I love working with people.
Yeah. Look, Jack Nicholson has played plenty of creepy characters and he's constantly smiling. So you can work it in. You can work it in.
Well, I directed it, so I didn't mind fucking it up. It's fine.
Yeah, thank you.
I think we've learned that the correct way to do it work is with other people. And that's you've chosen more wisely than we have, I think.
And yet people want more of what you do. So listen, it all evens
not
out.
Not specifically
somehow.
More of what we do, but like
In theory.
It's all just on paper at this point.
We've come to the end of we've got to play a game with you before we go.
Great.
But before we do that, is there anything specific that you want to plug?
We talked about my podcast, the JV Club. I guess the only other thing that I would say is not exactly new, but, I got to make a web series that everybody can watch, on, I think it's just on YouTube now as well as IFC, but, a little show that I created and co-wrote and starred in called Fortune Rookie, in which I play sort of shittier version of myself who is told by someone in a bathroom that I have psychic powers. And so I decide to quit the business and become a sort of fortune teller full time without any knowledge of what it takes to do that. And like with the podcast, I got an obscene amount of really talented, far more famous people to do it with me. And so the first episode, you know, Fred Armisen is sort of the first other person that you see on screen. And it's weird and super fun, and I'm so proud of it. And it was, like you were saying, the reason I thought of it with the horror musical is I'm just giddy the whole time. Like, I'm just having to tamp down the joy every second that we made that thing. So it's called Fortune Rookie, little pun on Fortune Cookie. And yeah, you can just watch it on YouTube. Now, having said that, can you see it in the UK? I may have had this conversation before where it's like hard to find or impossible. I don't know. So I've said now I've promoted something that's utterly unworkable.
People have ways of finding these things.
Okay. Steal it.
So, Janet, it is now time for me to hand over to Nathaniel, and he is going to play the game. Okay, Nathaniel, explain the rules.
Okay, this game is called Better or Worse, and you have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the person before, based entirely on my own opinions. Okay?
On your opinions?
On my opinions, correct.
Okay.
Beginning with Goldie Hawn, high card, but is Pierce Brosnan better or worse than Goldie Hawn?
In terms of what you think, what I think you think.
Yes.
Worse.
Worse. Not necessarily bad, just worse than Goldie Hawn.
Yeah.
Piers Morgan, better or worse than Pierce Brosnan?
So I can just cheat and listen to all of Nick's answers.
Yeah, but he doesn't know each other.
That's just your
opinion. Know each other.
Yeah. Barely know each other. That's just what he thinks. Well, that's what he thinks.
Piers Morgan, worse.
Whoa. Yeah, the worst. Morgan Freeman, better or worse than Piers Morgan?
Better.
Martin Freeman, better or worse than Morgan Freeman?
I would guess better, but
worse.
Maybe because
not necessarily.
All right.
Not necessarily bad. Just worse.
Yeah. Just worse.
Martin Scorsese.
Again, choice of words. Better or worse? Very interesting, considering that it's not worse. It's just worse.
It's worse.
Okay, sorry.
Martin Scorsese, better or worse than Martin Freeman?
Better.
I mean, better?
Better.
Yeah.
Martin Sheen, better or worse than Martin
Scorsese? Hurry up, Nathaniel.
Martin Sheen, better or worse than Martin Scorsese? Worse.
Worse, yeah. Charlie Sheen, better or worse than Martin Sheen?
Worse.
Correct. Emilio Estevez, better or worse than Charlie Sheen?
Better.
Better. Amelia Clark, better or worse than Emilio Estevez?
Better?
Worse, I think. Clark Gable, better or worse than Amelia Clark?
Worse.
Better. I think it's an eight.
Sorry.
Seven.
You got a seven. Okay, so you scored a seven, which isn't as good as Jen Brister, Thomas Coombs, Jason Manford, Joey Scaldini with 10, Ken Cheng, Harry Hill, Luke Morley with 9, Susie Dent, Charles Eston, Eddie Hearn, David Hepworth, Magical Bone, Samantha Morton, Matt Okine, Miranda Raisin, Chris Stark and Stu Whiffen with 8, but is as good as James King, Henry Norman, Johnny Vegas with 7, and better than Gary Delaney with 6. So well done. Thank you so much for coming on to our show, Jen.
And I am, by the way, worse than all of the people you named, so it feels right. Better or worse?
Better than us. So I think it evens out, actually. We're out of time. Thanks, everyone, for listening. That's goodbye from me. It's goodbye from Nathaniel. It's goodbye from Janet.
Oh, yes, it's goodbye from me.
And everyone stay safe, and we'll listen to... you listen to us next week, but we won't listen to you, unless you write into us, and then we'll read out your fan mail. Thank you. All right, goodbye.
Bye.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.